Now, Eddie, I had said we were going to play, in your honor, Big Head Todd all show, and you keep bucking this, right?
You know, I literally told you, Jimmy, and our executive producer, Todd Meyer, that when I tried using Spotify, my computer completely froze.
You don't have, couldn't do anything. We don't have Big Head Todd in any of the B archives?
I don't have access to that playlist.
Okay, well... I was wondering about that, by the way. The musical archives that we have here at Urban One Radio, we'll see if they have Big Head Todd and the Monsters. How's that? I'd like to hear Broken Hearted Savior before the end of the show.
Eddie, I just like the hard work you're doing.
You do work hard, Eddie. I will give you that. Although today it's very clear you have not had your macho tea because your energy level a little off. Stephen Holder joins us now. I'm sure thrilled to be doing so based on that segue from ESPN.com. He joins us on the always busy and shockingly unsponsored guest line. Stephen, you have a new gig because you are the Colts beat writer for the Indianapolis Colts for ESPN. But in addition to that, and I say this in all seriousness, even though I'm being flippant about your role, but I was saying to somebody yesterday, right now, Caitlin Clark might be the most marketable or nationally spotlighted athlete in the city of Indianapolis. And that has led to you doing a little bit for ESPN in that regard, correct?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I'm available for whatever I'm needed for. You know, it's kind of like we always talk about position flexibility with draft picks. So I'm that, like, Swiss Army knife offensive lineman. You need him to cover – I'm sorry, you need him to go play right guard. I can do that. I can fake it at right tackle if you need me to. I probably won't be great, but I can do it. It's passable. But I need tight end help. You know, so yeah, we're probably taking the analogy too far here, but yes. Listen, you want to, it's like anywhere you work, right? If you work in an office, you want to work on the project that the boss cares about, right? And so right now, what really matters at ESPN, or one of the things that really matters, is Caitlin Clark. So, hey, sign me up.
Unless that job involves playing music, then that's Eddie Garrison.
That's
or
right.
Thwarting
that's
the bosses. I know we're rewinding.
There are exceptions.
Exceptions to every rule, most certainly. I know we're rewinding about 4 days here, but Stephen, when you are on the scene, oftentimes, and I appreciate this, and I think that Colts fans probably do too, you elaborate more on a quote from Ballard about like where his perspective is, where you think he's coming right from, because you've been on the beat for as long as you have. And one of them was, I believe on night one, or perhaps it was, you know, the second day, but either way, it was reaction to the selection of Latu and their conversations about trying to get up in the draft. And you would opine that you'd felt like that the hint was they were trying to move up higher in the first round to select an offensive player. As you've gathered now 4 days since, do you still stand by that was likely the case? And how is there any more clarity on how difficult it was for them in their attempts to move up if they did indeed try to, like Ballard said they did?
Right. So I still am of the belief that it was an offensive player, likely a wide receiver. I do not think it was Brock Bowers, which is not to say they would not have drafted Brock Bowers had he fallen. I don't know. I'm not
right,
sort of commenting one way or the other on that, because I just don't know. But, you know, I think it's wide receiver. That was my sense. I don't think they were ever in the neighborhood of getting Marvin Harrison. You know, could they have gotten Neighbors? Probably not. Doomsday? I don't know. I think here's the thing. Here's the most important thing. We didn't see movement in the top 10. I think we saw one move, right, from 11 to 10, if I'm not mistaken. So, which is not a very dramatic move, and certainly not as costly as it would have been for the Colts to go from 15 to, you know, 6 or 7, for example, right? So what that tells me, right, that we did not see movement, that tells me people were very happy to stay home. Particularly with the way the quarterbacks were flying off the board, if you were a team in the market for a quarterback, you would have had to move pretty high. And still, we did not see that movement, which tells me that teams didn't have the appetite to move down. So I think those statements he made were believable when he says that look, we tried, but there just wasn't any takers. I think it's plausible. It's definitely plausible. A lot of times you do see movement in the top 10, and we did not see it practically at all. So that to me suggested that that was a true statement.
Steven,
now, wait, one last thing. What that doesn't prove or disprove is how much they were offering. That's what we can't speak to, right? What were they offering? What were they willing to part with? I mean, because everybody has a price, right? But of course, we're talking about here, we're talking about future number ones most likely. And once you get into that conversation, you got to have a strong stomach, you know, to be able to make that kind of move.
Steven, in terms of Latu, in your opinion, the Colts drafted 15th, okay? When it came to it and they were on the clock, Latu was the guy that clearly most impressed them, if you will, or was the top of their list. At what point in the draft do you think he made it to the top of their list? Now, let me explain what I mean by that. When the night began, I'm assuming that they did not say, no matter what, like the 15, like this is the guy that we're taking. But it started to fall that way where he was there, and so thus he's kind of moving his way up on the list, if you will. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, do you think that they went into it saying, man, if that guy's there, we're taking him? Or do you think they had no idea he was going to be there, and then eventually, as it started to fall, they're like, okay, this is the guy so long as he's available?
Well, yeah, here's what they do. You rank your players. You got your top players, whatever that number is. And I think Chris Ballard, he told us a couple of weeks ago, he said they thought there were between 19 and 21, roughly, first-round quality players, meaning that on their board, these players were in the tier of first-rounders. And so whatever else anybody else thinks, it's irrelevant, right? It's all about your assessment. How do they fit your team, your scheme? What are you going to do with them, with your coaches, right? So once they've gone through that process, they figured that 19 to 21 was the number of first-round quality players. Now, once you get there, you've got them ranked, they just come off the board the way they do, in whatever order they come off. And I can't say this with 100% certainty, but it does feel like this was one of those drafts where their top players in this draft were offensive players. Clearly, we know that just from the way the order went. And the expectation by the Colts was that there were going to be lots of offensive players. Chris Ballard said that as well. So you got to think at the top of their board were, you know, a cluster of offensive players. And then whenever they got past that, the next guy on the board, I believe, was Latu. The offensive players went, 1 through 14. Once you got past that, at some point, somebody's top player at that point was going to be a defensive player. I think a lot of those offensive selections were need selections, but also some of them were just those guys were considered to be elite prospects. But once you got past 14, I mean, he had to be very high on their board. They took him, if not the top player, right? They took him over every other defensive player, which tells me a couple things. Number one, they are not worried about the injury whatsoever because they had, talking about the neck injury of Latu, they had their choice of any defensive player, and they took the guy with the history of a neck injury, meaning that even in spite of that, he still was a superior choice over Turner or any other defensive backs, any other defensive player. So that is significant conviction. Significant in my mind, because you know you're going to be second guessed, and still they didn't give a damn. They said, no, he's our guy in spite of all of that. So that tells me they have significant conviction about the guy. Doesn't mean they're going to be right. All we can do is go by, look, all right, they're the experts. This is what they say, and this is what they determined, and then we'll see, you know? So I don't know if I answered your question, but I think that they came into it with a very high grade on this player and with the expectation that a lot of offensive players were going to be drafted early. So I think it fell the way they expected, probably even more so, and then their player fell in their lap. I believe that.
Steven Holder, you had a chance to speak with, I don't know about all, but more than one of the Colts draft selections once they were drafted to Indianapolis. Right. In your conversations with them, And maybe it might be in the group conversations. Maybe it was an answer they gave to someone else other than yourself. But in assessing these players, give me an anecdote or a story or just a perception you had, good or bad, about one of the Colts selections that most jumped out or was memorable to you.
Right. Well, I would say one guy that's interesting, I have no idea if he'll play this year. I mean, he may even be a project. I have no idea. But look at Micah Abraham, sixth-round pick. He's a corner from Marshall. He's played a few positions, actually. You talk about pedigree and polish, just an understanding of football. This guy, his father, Donnie Abraham, played corner for 9 seasons. He's actually a coach in, was it the UFL now, and was an accomplished high school coach in the Tampa Bay area. I remember him from my days down there. And his uncle, or I'm sorry, his cousin, I should say, was 12 seasons in the NFL as well. So like you're talking about a guy who's been around this game at a very high level, understands football, son of a coach. I think I love those guys because they have a higher level of understanding about football. Right. So we'll see. I like those. I think sometimes those guys with that kind of background, they kind of overachieve sometimes because they understand football at just such a high level that it gives them an edge. What he doesn't have in maybe size or speed, you know, sometimes you can make up for it in just football IQ. So we'll see. I mean, they have done a good job with late round defensive picks, the Colts. I'm not promising you that this is going to be one, but they have had some finds in the late rounds on defense in particular. And then the ultimate example, frankly, is Zaire Franklin. Okay. But even if you look at EJ Speed, who was an unknown guy, Tarleton State. I have no idea where that is. It's somewhere in
Tarleton.
Exactly. Exactly. Where the hell is that? I don't know. Doesn't matter. They found him in the 5th round. They picked him when nobody really was looking for this kid, and he's gone on to be a very good player for them. They've done it in other cases as well. Nate Hairston is another guy. I think back in the 2017 or 18 draft, they found him, I believe, in the 6th round. And he ended up, you know, becoming a part-time starter at nickel corner for them and has started quite a few games in the NFL. So, you know, they have a track record here. They actually have more consistent results in the middle and later rounds than even the higher rounds to some degree. Just because the expectations are so low when you get to the, you know, the 4th, 5th, 6th round. The expectations are so low that you really – it's a flip a coin, you know, proposition whether these guys even make the team. But the Colts have, to their credit, they found a lot of quality players in those rounds who have not only made the team but contributed in major ways in some cases.
Steven, I listen, I don't want to I'm not here to like call you out, right? I mean,
yeah.
But Tarleton State, and I know this only cuz we've had EJ Speed on the show a few times. It's in Texas, right? But
it is in Texas. I do know that.
Do you know what town it's in Texas?
Is it Tarleton, perhaps?
That would be a logical guess, but right. I'm a little disappointed that you don't know this. It's in Stephenville, Texas.
You learn something every day.
Now, of all people, shouldn't you know that, right?
I mean, should I?
I mean, here's the thing.
What is the population of this place, right?
Well, here's the thing, okay?
Where are you right now? And I'll answer that question.
If you were to go to Stephenville High School, and they're getting ready to set up for an extra point, then right there, there's a guy on the field that is absolutely your mascot, right? Because can you imagine being the holder of Stephenville? I mean, come on,
oh
right?
Oh, my God.
I mean,
this conversation is right up your alley.
It is, right?
By the way, Google is your friend. The population of Stephenville, Texas in the 2022 census.
Let's guess. I'm going.
Are you the NFL guessing this, or are you?
Now,
like,
are we including this? Yeah, that's right. According to the NFL, 1.6 million people live in Stephenville, Texas. Half of which were at the draft. Okay, Stephen, are we going with the non-student population, just the town of Stephenville?
Yeah, just actual permanent residents. Yes.
Okay, I'll go with 23,178. Jimmy, your guess.
27,405.
Okay, Eddie.
12,000.
All right. Steven, the answer is?
The two of you are over. He's not, but he's not close.
13,640.
Okay. 21,600.
All right.
All of them
named Steven, by the way. Hey, did the we talked about this the other day, Steven, but did the Colts kind of quietly pull a savvy move here by selecting the heir apparent for Ryan Kelly and being able to hand over the keys theoretically and say 2 years to the guy that becomes their long-term center?
I think it was a consideration for sure. Whether that was the driving force behind that pick, and we're talking about Matt
Gonzalez.
Yes. In the third round, I don't know. I don't remember who's playing what position. They're all playing different positions here. I guess they got two options because Gonzalez plays. They have him as a tackle, but then
it's the kid out of Wisconsin. Bordellini. Correct. That's the one that theoretically is the center, right?
Yes. Correct. Right. But he was like they have him as a guard is why it's confusing. So like they say he's a guard. They say Gonzalez is a tackle. I don't know that either one of them are going to play the position that they're listed at. But anyhow, so anyway, Bordellini. I actually do think that's a consideration when they picked him. I'm not saying it's the single driving force behind that pick, you know, talking about the future of Ryan Kelly. But I do think Ryan Kelly at this point, you're probably a little bit year to year with him. I don't know if that's the way this is going to go. He's in the last year of his contract. I don't think they're going to sign him for some long-term contract extension. I do think you'll go short-term with Ryan Kelly. He's still playing well. He has had the concussion history, and that can be somewhat concerning. But he's played well when he's been out there. He made the Pro Bowl this year as an alternate. So I like how he's performed. But you're getting two things. You're getting depth on the interior, a guy who can play different spots. And then as you outlined, you're getting possibly the heir apparent of Ryan Kelly. So I think it serves two purposes there. One, short-term, one long-term. So I think I like that pick. And the other thing I would say here is that, you know, they had two offensive line picks in the third round and the fourth round. Now, we will never complain about offensive line selections. But that being said, like, they didn't have to do that, you know, because their offensive line is complete right now. You know, depth is always a question and all that. But what does that say to me? It actually, I think, speaks loudly to this draft being about not necessarily primary needs, but really just bringing in best player available or players they really had an eye on. They drafted like a team that loves their current roster and drafted without regard for like immediate needs. They really did. And whether they are proven right about that, time will tell. But they told me with this draft that we like our roster like a lot.
Well, clearly, given, you know, $200 million spent within free agency on their own. But yes, no doubt they doubled down on that in the draft. Stephen Holder, Colts beat writer for ESPN, is our guest. Stephen, I want to give you the list of Colts cornerbacks that I trust. Juju Brents. Kenny Moore. That's it. That's the list. Those are the cornerbacks that I am confident in going in to 2024. Clearly, that list is much larger for Chris Ballard and company. And yes, we get into the, you know, they had their pick of the litter, defensively speaking, at 15. They could have had anybody they wanted. They go edge. Latu very well could be exactly what they've been attempting to find for the better part of the last 7 years. But they made their decision. They did not want to go best available corner. They went best available edge rusher, and they really didn't address corner at all in this draft. So, one, what percentage chance or odds, whatever you want to give to it, would you say for them acquiring a veteran corner in the next couple of months? And two, if those odds are low or if it's zero, how big of a bet is being made on their current cornerback room?
So I think there's a probably a low-ish chance of them acquiring a cornerback. I actually think the odds are a little higher of them acquiring another safety, like a veteran safety. That's just what I think, just because they have fewer bodies there, and I think they have some issues there that we aren't talking about enough. So we'll see what happens there. And there's also, by the way, there's also sort of a glut of veteran safeties out there that they can just kind of have their pick from. So we'll see what happens. But look, before the draft, Chris Ballard, on several occasions, I know back at the owners' meetings we had this conversation. He said it at his pre-draft press conference. He talked at length about his confidence in the secondary. And so I looked at that two ways. Okay, number one, the first possibility was that, all right, he's completely full of it, and this is a complete smokescreen, and he's drafting a corner. The other possibility was that, like, he was completely serious and not lying and not playing a game and was basically just telling the truth. And the more he said it, and in convincing fashion, the more I started to lean toward option number two. And the draft solidifies it, right? They completely believed that and do believe it. So, look, I look at it this way. They have a lot of unproven talent, as you said, but they do have a lot of players. I think the cream will rise to the top. Could they be wrong? Yes, they could be wrong. But we don't know enough about them yet, and so we don't have enough to judge from. I would argue the Colts don't either, but they certainly know more about the players than we do, right? And there's guys like Dallas Flowers coming back from that pretty serious injury, his Achilles tear. I just think they look at it like, look, we have five or six guys we can throw at this thing. We just need a couple of them to rise to the top. And we'll see if that happens. I don't know. Is it living dangerously? A little bit. But I also think in this draft, you know, going with Latu, that really is the Colts and Chris Ballard staying true to who they are. Offensive line, defensive line, right? That is what matters more than anything. And I think what we just have to come to terms with is that given the choice to pick between the trenches and something else, if all things being equal, if the player in the trenches is an equal quality player, they're going to go with the trenches. That's just what they've done, and that's what they did here.
Stephen Holder is our guest, covers the Colts for ESPN.com. Stephen, when you look at what happened post-draft for the Colts, their selection of Adonai Mitchell, the investment they made in O-line, and the fact that there was no real threat in place post-draft for a backup running back, was Jonathan Taylor one of the biggest winners post-draft for the Colts? And do you envision him being on pace for another 300-plus touch season with all of that?
Right. So, yeah, I mean, it speaks to what they think of him for sure. There's no question about that. I would say that if they get, you know, talk to JMV about this, if they get the version of Jonathan Taylor that they got last year, this is going to be one hell of an offense. All right. We still have no idea what Anthony Richardson and Jonathan Taylor look like on the field at the same time because we haven't seen it. That's not a thing. It hasn't been a thing so far. So if you get those two out there, I think Michael Pittman said it a couple of weeks ago. He says, I think we'll have the best RPO game in the NFL. I don't think it's a crazy statement. I really don't. You know, Shane Steichen has I've asked him about this a couple of times, and he has this like smirk when you ask him about what he's kind of dialing up and drawing up in this offseason period where he has time to kind of go back and think about how they're going to attack this. He has this smirk that comes to his face like, oh, just you wait, buddy. You know, and it's like this devilish smile. And it's true. Like, he's really got some stuff up his sleeve. So that's the first thing. Yes, it says a lot about Jonathan Taylor. I also think they believe that there is some potential there with Trey Sermon, Tyler Goodson, and who else is there? They've got I'm forgetting someone. Evan. Why am I?
Evan Hull.
Evan Hull. Jesus.
So anyway, I mean, I cheated too. It's okay. It's all right.
Yeah. So anyway, they actually believe between the three of them and whoever else you bring in as an undrafted free agent, that they do think that there's enough there, you know, to kind of fill the backfield. But it's going to be a different situation. There's no doubt. Look, I mean, last year when JT was down, Zach Moss, you knew you had a capable fill-in there, a proven fill-in. So this is going to be a little different. But, you know, look, I mean, Trey Sermon had some good snaps for him last year. Tyler Goodson, look, that final play against Houston notwithstanding, he does have a lot of upside and is a very accomplished college running back. So I think they like what they see there and like the potential. And certainly Evan Hull is a very accomplished college player as well.
Steven, I want to conclude with this because you were around the Indiana Fever, and I think it's a massive story with Caitlin Clark's, you know, how she meshes in with her teammates, how her teammates mesh in with somebody who is clearly the biggest star in the league upon entry. You've been around a lot of professional athletes. You've covered a lot of training camps and workouts and those kinds of things. What was your perception, not only of Caitlin Clark, but also in the reactions to Caitlin Clark and the molding of a team with Caitlin Clark being dropped into it with those players that are already existing for the Fever?
Yeah, it's a good question because there is, like, we've seen like a little bit of resentment is way too strong of a word, right? But we've seen a little bit of irritation around the WNBA from some veterans, like, all right, she's great, but damn, you know? And, you know, I get it. Like, maybe people are a little bit fatigued with the hype, and I understand that. You know, these players are competitive. That's why they're the best in the world. But anyhow, you don't sense any of that in, you know, just the one brief interaction that I was able to have, but just one day of coverage. But you certainly didn't sense that. In fact, they really seem to be embracing it. I mean, I thought their head coach, Christy Sides, she didn't shy away from it at all. I wondered how she might handle it, right? Would she just kind of downplay, like, hey, she's just one of the players, right? Just one of 12 or 15 or whatever. She didn't do that at all. She's leaning all the way into it. And she talked about how, you know, she gets so excited during practice. She's got to compose herself. And, like, they're not shying away from this. I give Aaliyah Boston a lot of credit, too, because she's a star in her own right, right? She's the rookie of the year last year, first overall pick herself. And she gave a lot of credit to Caitlin Clark in terms of how she's going to change their offense and basically completely overhaul what they're able to do. And she's going to be a beneficiary of that. You know, you're talking about someone who's a great passer, and Aaliyah Boston plays in the post. So it's great for her. And she embraces that. So I love that they are just calling it like it is. She's a great player. She's going to have an immediate impact. And they're going to go as far as she can lift them, I think, you know, because she's the biggest difference in this team. And they're not shying away from that. And I think, you know what, you might as well. Because, like, who are we kidding, right? I love that.
Your designation on this program now within the company, Steven, we have your title. You are officially the mayor of Stephenville. How's that?
That sounds like a promotion. I'll take it. Of course, it comes with a raise, right?
That's right. So of course.
Yes.
The raise is that I'll pay you a little more next year to hang out with me at Pacer Games. Steven, we appreciate
it. But hey, by the way, I'm. What are the odds tonight that if you know Bobby Portis, you know, gets a little frisky, we get Jenny, assistant coach Jenny, jumps in there and handles that again.
Hey,
I love
she is out there when things mix up, man. She's out there playing peacemaker immediately, right? Pulling people away.
I loved it. So
we'll see if it happens.
I'm looking for that. That was my takeaway from the last game, by the way.
We'll see if they're back here for a game six, but we shall see. You know. All right, Steven, appreciate it.
All right, guys. Cheers.
All right, Steven Holder from ESPN.com. One of the things I've always wondered every time that I'm in Manhattan, which is the greatest city in the world, walking around, and I think to myself, if you played for the Giants or the Jets, would you live in Jersey or would you actually live in New York City? I guess we can ask our next guest that. He is a high school, is it teammate or classmate, Eddie, of Tyrone Tracy, or were you different years?
He was a year younger than me, so we were classmates for 3 years.
So you're the guy that called him Little Tyrone because he was a year below you, right?
Never.
Tyrone Tracy Jr. is now a New York football giant. after his career at Purdue and Decatur Central, and we had had him on going into the combine, and here he was, boom, fifth round. Is that correct, fifth round pick, Tyrone?
Yes, sir. Fifth round, pick 156.
I was going to say, you don't care what round, right? You just take me through this. First off, congratulations. And I'd like to know, how does the evening go? Like, in other words, how do you find out? How soon before it's announced on television did you know that you're going to be a Giant? And take me through the process leading up to finding out that you were going to be drafted.
Yeah, so when they call you a couple picks beforehand, so I think like Baltimore was the pick before me. So I got the call like before the Baltimore pick even like got presented. So you get the call like ahead so that you know they can you know conversate. You can talk to the GM, you can talk to the head coach, and like everything's not rushed. So like obviously you have emotions and stuff like that that goes through it. But yeah, before everything, I was, you know, pretty anxious. I had like a lot of anxiety. I didn't know what was going to happen. I was projected to go fourth round, fell to the fifth just due to, you know, just how the draft goes. You know, some people fail even further than me. So I'm just blessed to be, you know, taken in the fifth. But yeah, when I got the call, I was actually like super stoked because I didn't know like, you know, if it was the Jets or the Giants, because they both were New Jersey. So I didn't know which one it was. I wasn't actually watching the draft. I was in a different room with my family and just like, you know, enjoying the day because, you know, again, the draft is super, high emotions and I didn't want to just continue to stare at the screen. But when I got the call, it was super like, it was a relief. But it was a super dope moment for me and my family. It was like pure joy, very genuine. I wish I could do it over. I really do. I wish I could do it over again.
Did you cry?
Oh, yeah. Nah, it was like, I told myself I thought I was going to be a tough guy. But, I cried like a little baby. But I think that's all just because of, you know, I worked, you know, 20 years for this moment. So, I definitely let out my emotions for sure.
So they basically say to you, assuming like, hey, you know, Tyrone, this is the New York Giants, and we're going to take you here, assuming that you're on the clock. I mean, I guess they would know, or they're assuming that Baltimore did not. Did anybody else call you leading up to that moment to say, hey, we're going to take you, and then, you know, something happened where they went in a different direction? I know Reggie Wayne, for example, talks about how the Washington, at that time, Redskins had told him, we are taking you. And then they took Rod Gardner and not him. And he's like, what in the world? Anything like that happen?
No, so not like necessarily during the draft. I got like text messages from certain coaches and like, hey, you know, hey, it was like somebody from the Chargers. They said, you know, well, I'm rooting for you. I'm pulling for you. But like, they never, you know, they never took me. I got text messages from like, you know, other teams as well. But you know, again, they never took me. But then even like, you know, during the pre-draft process, like, you know, teams would say, you know, we like you, we think, you know, highly of you, we want you to go this high or whatever. And again, like when a draft actually comes and it gets here, they're not choosing you. So, you can't really, I mean, you can believe them, but like, you also got to understand that it's a business behind the rest of there's a lot of draft picks. So like, you're not the only guy they're talking to.
Tyrone Tracy Jr. is our guest, the Purdue Boilermaker and now a member of the New York Giants. Tyrone, take us through the call itself. Like, what do you remember? Who all did you get a chance to talk to? Have you talked to Coach Dable yet? And take us through just in general. We saw the video, and the video is really, really cool. All those reactions, but especially yours and your family being around you and celebrating together. Take us through the day as a whole.
Yeah, so I thought it was a day like on the high energy. Like I'm a high energy person, so like, I started the day off like on high energy, you know, good vibes, good energy, very positive. And then as like the fourth round started going, you know, I started getting a little anxious, a little nervous. Then towards the fourth round, I'm getting a little bit more like, you know, my emotions are really high right now. You know, I'm getting irritated because, you know, teams that told me this ain't really doing what they said. And you know, this again, I'm living the draft. Like, I'm literally living the draft, and I'm just going through it. And then as, you know, the fifth round comes, again, like, you know, I think I went, like, mid to late fifth round. So, like, beginning of fifth round, I'm thinking in my head, like, okay, this is the round I'm going to go. So I'm waiting any time, any moment. Like, it could be a phone call. So I'm literally just staring at my phone waiting for a phone call. But then, you know, again, like I said, I had to get up because I was getting so irritated with the whole process of waiting. I mean, being patient, so I had to get up and, you know, kind of, like, change the energy and change the environment around me. But when I actually got the I don't really remember anything, to be honest, because, like, I kind of, like, blacked out. I just remember saying, yes, it's Tyrone Tracy. And I just remember him saying, you know, we about to turn in the car to turn you into a New York Giant. And after that, I just started sobbing and crying. And, like, I just, because at that moment, I realized that, like, my dream has just become reality in, like, a split second. And all these things of, like, these talks and all these, like, these long nights, you know, early mornings of training, like, it's all paid off. So, yeah, it was a great moment for me and my family.
Tyrone, when you look back, Tyrone Tracy is our guest. And you can follow his journey, by the way, not only looking back at this process, but now as he works his way into the NFL on Instagram, I am_TTJXI. I would assume that means I am Tyrone Tracy Jr. number 11, but TTJXI with an underscore in between. We'll get that to you in the end. But Tyrone, when you look back at your journey from, you know, having Eddie Garrison spotting for you in Decatur Central in the weight room to going to Purdue, you know, all of it. When was the moment, I guess, that was your epiphany that this was a possibility? And what separated you from so many that have the same dream but didn't get there?
To be honest with you, I'm grateful. Looking back on it, I just think I was I think that's what separates the good from the great at any level. You know what I'm saying? They just consistent at what they're doing. And that's what happened, you know, even when I was younger in high school. And, you know, Eddie, he can attest for me. You know, I used to be on the field at 6 in the morning every day. I literally used to have to get kicked off the football field in high school and jump the fence to get back on the football field just because I was going to work out. And I was, like, determined that I was going to work out. And if I couldn't get on the football field, I would, you know, find open grass and I'd work out there. And I'd bring my brothers with me. I'd bring my cousin with me. Like, I was just consistent with what I was doing. And I just kind of had faith that it was going to work out at the end of the day. And that's the same thing that happened in college. When you work hard for something, you know, results are going to follow one way or another. And I think that's what's going to carry me into I know that's what's going to carry me into the NFL as well. You know, I'm going to be consistent with what I do. My work ethic is going to carry me, you know, to the end of my career. And again, whatever happens in between, you know, I'm going to let the results speak for itself.
Tyrone, what are you most looking forward to next through this process? Now that you've, you know, been selected, now you're a giant as you get ready for this next step in your life and get ready for, you know, rookie mini camps and get ready for training camp onward there. What are you next most looking forward to?
I mean, to be honest with you, the simplest way to say this, I'm just ready to put on an NFL uniform. You know, I've watched the draft for the last, you know, 11 years, like literally watched that for the last 11 years on my couch and my mom and dad's crib. And for me to be picked, I just want to put on a uniform and be like, man, you know, I made it. Like, that's not the end of the road for me. I know that personally, and I know that, you know, for me and my family as well. That's my first thing I'm looking forward to. The second thing I'm looking forward to is the information side of it. I'm a big football fanatic. You know, I love football. I love, you know, learning the knowledge behind it and all the details. So, like, I'm about to be working with, you know, coaches that have been in the league for 20 years, 30 years, and they have, you know, tons of experience for years and years. So, like, I'm about to learn football at a higher level. So the knowledge behind it is going to be, like, higher than I've ever experienced. So Yeah, I'm just ready for that as well, because now, like, you know, I get to work on my craft, and, you know, I think I'm pretty damn good football player right now. So, you know, once I get this extra knowledge in me and, you know, start obtaining it and also applying it on the football field, I think, you know, again, I think I'll see some results.
What, by the way, how much did you talk with Joe Shane, the general manager of the New York Giants? Because, you know, he's an Indiana guy, right? Went to DePaul.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's not afraid to reach out and take chances, because he also invited Wabash's quarterback to rookie camp. And if you're at DePaul, that's like a cardinal sin, but you got to find good players where you can. So congratulations to Liam Thompson as well. But how much did you talk to him? And did you guys talk about the Indiana connection at all?
To be honest with you, I didn't really talk to the Giants that much. I talked to him one time throughout this whole process. And that's like kind of it's normal, but it's also not normal. But just because, you know, they felt good about me. They knew who I was. They had a lot of information about me. So they didn't, you know, have to, you know, ask any more questions or anything like that. So they, I didn't really talk to them that much. I talked to them at the Farm Bowl, which is a bowl game. When I was there, I talked to them the whole, like, front office. I talked to them there. But, again, like, that was really it. And I had a meeting with the running back coach. And we talked to Indiana a little bit, but it was really the assistant general manager that was asking most of the questions. They said they liked me from the jump. They said I had a good personality. They said, you know, I fit their scheme very well. Like, all these things that I remember they said about me, but, again, I didn't think they were going to pick me just because I didn't have many conversations with them. So I didn't think, you know, I was high on their list.
Hey, Tyrone, do you remember, I mean, you would have been a kid, I'm going to guess you were like 11, 12 years old when the Super Bowl was in Indianapolis. I mean, do you have clear memories of the Super Bowl being in Indy?
So, yes, I do. I remember the Super Bowl, and I remember, like, Indy, like, downtown Indy was, like, some of the funnest times I've been around. They had, like, zip lines and, like, Ferris wheel. They had so much stuff going on downtown. And I remember, like, having a bad party for it, you know, it was versus the Bears. And I don't remember, like, every single detail, because I wasn't watching it, you know what I'm saying? I wasn't, like, you know, super into the game, but I remember, you know, what I was doing at the time.
Well, isn't it bizarre, though, to go back and think about that and think about you as a kid seeing the zip lines and everything that went into the Super Bowl, and if you could go back and tell that kid that the team that was going to win the Super Bowl and hoist the Lombardi Trophy at Lucas Oil Stadium is the one that you were actually going to be a part of.
Yeah.
Pretty bizarre, yeah, right?
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
Tyrone, in conclusion here, how much has your parents, Laverna and your dad, Tyrone, and your brothers, Kenny and Javon, and I know you played with your cousin Larry growing up too, how much do they mean to you for you to get to where you are now?
Oh, man. I'm a huge family guy, man. They mean literally the world to me. They have no idea, honestly, just from the point of, like, you know, how our family is. Like, we obviously, we're a very tight-knit family, not even just, you know, me and my brother, but, like, you know, my uncle. You know, I got two uncles. I got my mom's side and my dad's side. So, like, you know, we're just a very tight-knit family. You know, we had this draft party, and I kid you not, like, everybody came out to support because, again, like I said, we have a tight-knit family. And when things like this happen, you know, you want to be a part of it. You want to support, you know, good or bad. Like, no, they didn't know I was going to get drafted or not, but they wanted to come out and just support. But nah, man, my brothers, they mean the world to me. They the reason why I do this. They're my backbone. And again, like I said, they have no idea how much they mean to me. But I mean, they throughout this process, they got a little piece of it just because, like, you know, I also, like, you know, explained to them, you know, how I felt, but then also explained to them, you know, they the reason I'm here right now, because during my hard times, I know that they looking at me. And, you know, my main thing, I don't want to let them down. I don't want them to, you know, look at me and see that I either gave up or I'm giving up or anything like that. So, like, I continue to push through any hardships, any, you know, trials and tribulations that I'm going through. So, yeah, they mean a lot to me, to say the least.
Are you going
to
live in Manhattan or are you going to live in New Jersey?
New Jersey. I'll be in New Jersey.
It's probably smart, yeah.
I heard the New Jersey taxes a little bit cheaper.
Not only that, but I mean, you're practicing and playing in New Jersey. I mean, realistically, there's no reason for you to be in, and I love New York, right? But there's no reason to be in New York City because everything takes place now in New Jersey. But
yeah.
You head out when? So the next, like, I guess the way that things work now is your next responsibility is what?
To rookie minicamp next Thursday.
Man, not waste any time, Jimmy.
Quick turnaround.
Right back on the horse.
Yeah.
Tyrone,
yeah,
we appreciate it. Give us the Instagram account one more time in case anybody wants to follow the journey when you head out there to Jersey.
Yeah, so anybody want to follow me, I'll be on Instagram at @IAM_TTJXI. I'm usually, you know, I'm always on Instagram. I post a lot. I'm pretty active with the fans. So, yeah, hit me up. You know, I'll be asking questions and so I can, you know, start engaging with the fans and having more content as well.
All right, go G-Men. Have fun in New York or New Jersey specifically. And congratulations again on a great journey and representing Decatur Central and Purdue well.
Yes, sir. I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you, Tyrone, guys, for having me as well.
Appreciate it. Tyrone Tracy. So, technically speaking, I'm looking here. Everybody's going to send this out. Is it tomorrow's May 1st? So then we say it's May, right? But it's officially May here in the building because I look outside and there walks Al Unser Jr., two-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, of course, a Central Indiana resident, but always means it's race time. Little Al?
That's right. Hey,
welcome back. Good to see you.
Thanks for asking us to come in and say hello to everybody. Is it May yet? And I think it is.
Well, it is officially now, right? Let's get to that because... You know, first things first, the month itself, you know, for you, and this is something that's always fascinated me. I think a lot of people just assume that you grew up going to the Indianapolis 500-mile race. You won it twice, obviously, but yet you didn't actually come to the race itself until what, the year you were racing or the year before? Is that right?
That is correct. Yeah, the very first time I was here for the race, I was 11 years old, and it was 1973, and it was a heck of a year. Well, that was a bad year, you know.
You had to come back like 5 times, right?
And then the next time I came to the Indy 500 was 1982, because I knew I was coming in 83, and so I wanted to be there. But I did have an opportunity to come back here in 1978. I'm a sophomore in high school. Dad would leave for the month of May. That particular year... Dad left, and I started playing hooky from school. So I ditched class for like a week, and I got in trouble, extreme trouble. My sisters, because they were good, they got the opportunity to come back here in 1978, and Dad wins the race. And quite honestly, that's the only thing that saved me from not being killed.
Right.
That
overshadowed
the
it, right?
The fact that he won the race. Yeah.
Okay. So, and I'm curious, like when in those days when you were younger, I mean, the Unser name is so synonymous with Indianapolis, but yet when you were, and you grew up around racing and you were in cars at a young age, but you have, you know, the whole family, your uncle, your mm-hmm. grandfather, your, mm-hmm. all of it. Mm-hmm. When did you realize almost that this was like the ultimate destiny path of what you were going to do?
I was 8 years old, and that was 1970. We were in Albuquerque. In those days, it was closed circuit TV on race day.
Yep.
Throughout the country. We were down at the Civic Auditorium in downtown Albuquerque and watching the race. And the Johnny Lightning car that Dad drove was just bigger than life. And I knew right then that's what I wanted to do. Yeah.
Al, we talk an awful lot around this month of May, the crossover of Indy 500, the racers, and the pacers, and the excitement that happens when you have the countdown of the greatest spectacle in racing and the pacers still being in the playoffs and alive and well.
Absolutely.
The second time you won the 500 in 94, that was really the middle of the Pacers-Knicks rivalry, Reggie Miller, Patrick Ewing,
yeah,
John Starks.
It was. I remember that.
What is it like from the driver's perspective? Because the 500 speaks for itself, but when you have that crossover of two passionate things that the city loves so much come together?
I just think it's a great thing. I think it's great for the whole city of Indianapolis, the whole state of Indiana. You know, I grew up and was raised and lived in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Okay, so we didn't have, and still to this day, there's no professional sports in Albuquerque. Okay, and so I never really had a football team that I was loyal to or a basketball team that I was loyal to and so on. I didn't go to college, okay, so because I went straight into racing. So I'm not alumni from any college sure. or anything like that. And so honestly, it's been since I moved back here full time in the fall of 2017 that I started going, you know, to my first basketball game, the Pacers and the football games, the Colts and so on. And so I have slowly, okay, but surely become very passionate fan for the Colts and for the Pacers. And what the Pacers are doing right now, I think is just absolutely phenomenal. My wife Norma has a lot to do with that because she's an Indiana girl and her dad was a basketball coach and so on. So she grew up with the basketball passion of Indiana. Okay. And, mm-hmm. and for me, it was just the movie, The Hoosiers.
Right. Okay? Right.
That was that. And, but now I've gained a great appreciation for the actual true love that Indiana has for basketball and what the Pacers are doing. I watched both the games, you know, and I was glued to it. And Norm is going, okay, if they win, we're definitely going to be going to round two of the Pacers games. And so I definitely want them to win because I want to go and go to Gamebridge and watch them play.
Well, that might very well be Pacers-Knicks like it was in 94
right.
when you won the race.
I think that would be just fantastic. I would love it.
If it's Pacers-Knicks, you have to be there because it's like we're just going to relive 94 all over again, right?
I love it. I love reliving 94.
You know, actually, it's funny. Around. I was just thinking about this. Little Al, Al Hunter Jr. is our guest. Your father drove the Johnny Lightning, which is, I think most people would say, one of the probably three or five most recognized iconic cars
yes.
in Indy 500 history.
Yes.
Arguably the most iconic car is the Beast that you drove in 94, the Mercedes mm-hmm. Penske car. It is so legendary. That car to me, and my understanding is I think it's in a Penske museum in Charlotte, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Roger has it. Roger yeah. has it. And so it's either in Scottsdale or somewhere in Charlotte.
Do you, this is a weird question, I realize, but do you feel like a connection to a car? Because that car was so iconic and so good, and there was so much legend. I mean, there's been a book written about it, for crying out loud.
Right, 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 right.
Do you feel like a sentiment to it?
Definitely. It took me to victory in 94. I feel the same way with the Galmer in 92.
Yeah.
Okay, you know, you get a connection with the cars that are really good to you that you win in. Okay, the ones that you lose in, you discard and throw away
right.
in the trash. Okay,
right.
But the ones you win in, they have a special place in your heart.
You know, the story of Indy to me, Al, is interesting because I don't know that people realize, and I don't think you'll be offended when I say this. Al Unser Jr. won the Indianapolis 500 in 1992 and 1994, but in reality, you know, Rick Gallus won in 1992 as well. Mm-hmm. Roger Penske won in 1994
yes.
as well. It is the it is a team sport. You got to have guys
absolutely.
Coming over the wall and you know all of it, right?
Mm.
And I think that your story embodies, and I want you to touch on this, the team and the feeling of racing itself, because I love seeing you at the racetrack because, and it's well documented, we don't have to get into it, but people know your journey has not always been smooth since your retirement,
correct.
But yet there are so many people that continued to bring you back in. The Brian Barnharts of the world, you know, people that mm-hmm. kept giving you chances, and now here you are as an ambassador of the sport. What does the family-like feel of racing mean to you?
It means everything. I mean, you know, it's a fraternity, and the fraternity takes care of their own. And it's throughout all the years that I've been in racing, you know, they're fierce competitors out on the racetrack, and the teams are fierce competitors. But that's on the racetrack, and when they're not on the racetrack, they're taking care of each other and so on. And so it truly is a family and a fraternity that we truly do love each other. We respect each other and so on. And yeah, I mean, and it has not changed. Okay, the driver's names, the formula for racing, you know, like today the cars are all the same, and they're super close and so on, and strategy is huge, and then when the yellows come, it's huge. But other than that, it's still the traditions and all that is still the same.
Do you miss it?
I do not miss it. I love racing, and I love going to all the races. I love watching F1. I love watching NASCAR. I love watching the World of Outlaws. I love NHRA. You know, I love what Tony Stewart's doing in there, and it's just racing's racing, and so I love that. Now, if I could be at a racetrack 24/7, I would. Okay, but driving the car and being under the stress and all that kind of stuff of just whatever it takes to win, I had my fun. And so I don't miss that.
What did you make of, Alan Sir Jr. is our guest. I mean, you obviously drove for Roger Penske amongst other teams, but, and you talk about, you know, one of the things that never changes in racing is the strategies and everything that goes into it. Obviously a big talking point has been the situation with, almost unprecedented, that the owner of a series would have his own team penalized and cost a victory with Joseph Newgarden in St. Petersburg, and them using push to pass when they were not supposed to, and whether or not they were intentionally doing that or it was dry. You've been in the cockpit. You've also been on the outside watching. What was your overall assessment of the Team Penske controversy that took place?
My first thought is that's not Roger. Okay, when I drove for Roger Penske, the cars were all legal, and that was the number one thing. You know, it's to stay fair and so on, and so that it didn't really register, you know, because that's not Roger's style that at all in any way. And so what I was kind of surprised about was how much traction it got, how much attention it actually got. Because I've been in the cars with push to pass, and yeah, there's a little advantage, but it's not like turbo lighting, you know, kind of thing. And so, you know, yeah, I watched Joseph Newgarden's press conference and so on, and he said, yeah, he felt it, but honest to God, it's not a big thing to begin with, and so I was just surprised on. How much attention it actually got, because to me it shouldn't have got that much attention. You know, it was something that a mistake was made. They fessed up to it, okay. When it was brought to their attention, they accepted it, okay. And so, time to move on.
Do you, as a driver, when you're in there? Here's my, and you tell me if this is like, Jake, you're overly optimistic or too kind, because I do like Joseph Newgarden and respect. I mean, you have to respect him as a driver, right?
Absolutely.
When you're in the cockpit, I think it's easy for us on the outside to say, well, you have to know, you know, when the button was on and available, you have to know that it wasn't, that it was a time period where it's not allowed. But then my thought is that with all the adrenaline and everything going on in the car, all of a sudden you realize it's there and you're thinking to yourself, I guess everybody has this. Okay, I guess I am allowed
Absolutely.
To use it now. Is that a plausible explanation?
If I could have it, I would be pushing that thing all day long. Okay? No matter what's going on, I'd be pushing it. And even if it didn't work, it just keep, you know, I mean, that's the competitiveness and so on. And so I could understand it. But, you know, with Roger, there's been, and with my family, there's been two times that there's been a protest, and he went in and fought the protest, okay? The first time was with Uncle Bobby in 1981 when there wasn't a blend line, and so they did some passing coming out of the pits and so on. He fought that, and he was correct, and they gave it back to him. With me, personally, in 1995 at Portland Grand Prix, we ran the car extremely low and the bottom of the car got warped and so on. And so at the end of the race, it didn't pass the 2-inch rule. But then we went in and proved that was arbitrary to whoever was underneath the car. It was where they put the blocks to on the bottom of the car. And so we won that back. And so with this one now with Newgarden, when I saw that Team Penske, Tim Cindric, accepted the penalty, and let's move on. That should have been the end of it. You know, I mean, it was a severe penalty. They didn't just get fined.
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay. They didn't, are just a few points taken away from them from moving them from first to fifth. They took them, they DQ'd both McLaughlin and Newgarden, and they got 0 points. They went all the way to the back, plus a hefty fine. Okay. And they accepted it. So let's move on. It was something that happened. I doubt very seriously if it'll ever happen again. Okay. And so, time to move on. That's how I feel about it. I was surprised with the traction and the attention that it did get.
Two-time Indy 500 winner Al Unser Jr. is our guest. Al, for first and second year drivers, what's the biggest piece of advice, or what's the most often asked question of you when trying to prepare for how to tackle IMS?
The key word about IMS and the month of May is patience. It's just patience. You know, you get out there and you get going and you get a rhythm going in practice and so on, and you're going to put a fast lap in. You got the draft all figured out, and then a yellow comes. And then you come in the pits, and then you go back out, and then you get everything all going again, and then another yellow comes. It's just, it can get frustrating, and then you start making mistakes that you shouldn't normally do and taking chances. That's during practice and so on. And so patience is the key word for anything around the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
What was your favorite part of May? I mean, when you were a part of it, like, what was of all the ceremonies and the rigors of what you go through, mm-hmm. what's the one that you actually, like, that you think to yourself, that actually is my favorite part?
The favorite part is race day. Totally. Because when we go out...
What time would you get up in the morning?
When the cannon would go off, would wake me up.
If you're sleeping there, you got no choice, right?
The cannon go off, but then I'd go back, I'd fall back asleep again. I'd normally get up 8 or 9 o'clock on race day morning and so on. And it was race day because when we walked out there was no driver intros back in that day. And so when we walked out to our car. And when I got in the car, that was the beginning of the end. Okay, so finally, race day
now
is here.
Now it's your time, right?
Race day is here. We're finally going to get this race underway. We've been here for 3 weeks. We've done nothing but practice and sponsor events and all this kind of stuff leading up to the race, qualifying and all that kind of stuff. And so that's what I felt my rookie year, when I my first rookie year in 83, race day morning, when I finally got in the car to begin the race, it was like a bunch of pressure off of me, because now it was the beginning of the end. You know, we're finally, in a few hours, the race is going to be over. We're going to know who won. You're going to know how you did and all that kind of stuff. And then we'll move on up to Milwaukee and get the championship going.
Was there ever a point during the 200 laps of the Indianapolis 500 where you're just kind of cruising along and you're, you know, okay, we got through the first stint and, you know, now I'm just going to kind of feel the car out and I'm not even sure. We might be on lap 78. We might be on 82. I'm not positive. I mean, where you're just kind of going through the motions, or is it intense the entire time?
Well, when you're running 220 mile an hour, it's intense,
right,
the whole time, okay? Just put that aside. And no, there's times during the race in my day, which the formula is different today, so it really doesn't compare. The most important thing to do is stay on the lead lap. That was the most important thing to do. And run the race, run the laps, you know, but stay on the lead lap. If you started to go down, you know, where
did
the leaders...
Did you know what position you're running at all times?
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. They kept me informed. Yep. And if the leaders started coming up behind me, then you needed to drive hard and you needed to stay on the lead lap. Today, everybody's so close. And the reliabilities of the cars are so good that it's not really about staying on the lead lap. It's staying with the pack, not so much the lead lap. It's staying with the pack going around there and staying out of trouble. And that in itself is a huge thing, because everybody's running in a pack.
Right.
And so during the race today, it's all about not letting anybody run into you, Okay,
and that's are there certain drivers that you knew, like if you come up on a pack and you say to yourself, that guy's crazy, I don't want to be around it, as opposed to that guy's reliable. You know what I mean?
Well, you kind of knew that before the race started.
That's what
okay?
I mean. Where you're like, I just don't want to be in that guy's pack,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. There's guys in my day that you wanted to stay away from.
Okay, now who?
But you gotta tell me I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go there.
Come on, the statute of limitations is up, right?
But today, it's a totally different thing. It's a totally different formula. And so that's what I love about the Indy 500. And I can look back over the history. In the 50s, when they were running roadsters, there was a formula that you needed to do to win the 500. In the 70s, that formula changed. In the 80s, with ground effects and all that, that formula changed. And then in the 90s, the formula changes. And so today, you know, it's just as difficult to win the Indy 500 today as it was in the 20s and 30s. It's hard to do. And so whenever the team does do well at Indy, they've done something.
You know, the Alan Sir Jr. is our guest. The one thing that Jimmy asked about, and it's really a good question, I wanted to end with this. When you talk about young drivers coming here, I want to know if this is true. I've always heard drivers say, you go through the practices, you go through qualifying, you do all that. Then you come out for the first time on race day, and you're like, wait a minute, this track is one-tenth as wide as it was for every other time because the crowd fills in. Do you ever get used to that, and is that true?
You do get used to it, and it was something that you know, thank God I had my dad to give me that experience because he warned me about it my rookie year, that when you come out there, the whole track's going to be different because all of a sudden the gray grandstand solid color that you've been used to for the entire year, whether you're testing or practice or anything like that, it's going to change color, and that changes the whole racetrack. And so stay focused. Don't really look at anything above the wall because nothing above the wall really matters. What matters is its track itself, and just stay focused.
Okay, lastly, I'm not going to put you on this spot. I'll ask your wife. Your wedding anniversary is when? What's your wedding anniversary? Either one of you guys
September
know?
September 30th.
September 30th. Look at that. He knew it right away. Here's the thing. Alan Sue Jr., here's your assignment on September 30th, okay? You guys need to go out. You need to have, like, the best dinner ever. You need to do whatever, and you need to pamper her because I have not seen you in the last – it's been how many years now since you guys have been married?
Three.
Every time I've seen you the last 3 years, you literally look like you're having the best day possible.
I am.
It's been a rocky road, so I speak for a lot of race fans in saying that that brings me great joy to see just the happiness of Alan Sir Jr. and the vibrance in the life of you.
Thank you.
And it's always good to see you at racetracks.
Yep, that's all Norma. Believe me.
Well, hey, it's your month, man. It's your time, right?
Yep.
Two-time winner of the Indianapolis 500, Alan Sir Jr. And you look good, by the way. You've been
working out?
Thank you.
We do. I was just making a radio spot for Exercise Inc. I've been doing that once a week, and I've actually feel better. I've gotten stronger and more energy, and I've actually lost a little bit of weight.
Well, I like that. So you'd be able to run the 109th Indianapolis 500, except for that you don't miss it, right?
That's correct.
That's the message. All right, Alan Sir Jr., as he mentioned, they'll be watching tonight, Pacers and Bucks in game number, this is what, game six, is that right, five? How do I keep – you know, I failed math, right?
We forgive you.
Many a time, right? I know this much. I know that 200 times 2.5 is 500.
There you go.
I do know that much. That's all I need to know. Joining us now on the always busy and shockingly unsponsored guest line is Jeremiah Johnson from Valley Sports and, of course, Pacers television broadcast up in Milwaukee. Pacers Bucks tonight. Jeremiah, I will ask you the same thing that I asked Chris yesterday. Maybe it sounds rhetorical, but in your opinion – is the knockout punch of a series the hardest one to land?
I don't know, because Rick Carlisle said the hardest game of the series was game four. And we have seen at times, and I've been watching the playoffs for years, even before being immersed in it, sometimes when teams are down 3-0 or 3-1, if you get a lead on them, they can start to see the end, and maybe they think about Cancun. I'm not so sure. So I'm not saying that will happen tonight, but I'm not necessarily going to buy into the fact that the last one is the hardest unless it is game seven.
And we still have no, and I'm assuming we will not until game time, definitive answer on the status of Giannis and Lillard, right?
Where did you come down on that question?
I think the hardest to land, I don't know about like in terms of schematically and X's and O's and things like that. I think psychologically the hardest to land is the knockout, if that makes sense. Certainly from a fan standpoint, it's like you're right there. And if you don't, there, if you were up 3-1 and you have the elimination at hand, then you start psyching yourself into why that one is the one you have to have. And there's almost as much, you almost weirdly put as much pressure on yourself as the team that is facing elimination. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I could see that. And if tonight's game goes Milwaukee's way, then you feel so much pressure coming back for game six, and you don't even want to encounter that situation. And I think I interrupted your question, but you're getting to Giannis and Damian Lillard. All we know right now is what they've said, which is doubtful, which, you know, questionable really seems like during the NBA season, it goes either way. Doubtful, you rarely see someone listed as doubtful and then play. If they're going to play at some point, I would say prior to tip-off, they would be upgraded to questionable. But if you don't ever see a change to the update or to the report, I would expect Doc Rivers, or maybe even they'll designate their status before his media availability. It's just so much later today than normal. I'm having a little bit of a difficult time getting adjusted. And I know many back home, it'll feel like a West Coast game with that late tip. And even Central time, it's a little after 8:30. So a lot of time to wait today, and maybe some are waiting and refreshing the injury report just to find out for sure about Damian Giannis.
Pacers sideline reporter for Bally Sports Indiana, Jeremiah Johnson, nice enough to take some time with us. Jeremiah, when we look back in the weeks shortly after the acquisition of Pascal Siakam, once things finally started to hit a groove for the Pacers, it felt like on a nightly basis that it could be a wide variety of players leading the charge in the scoring department. You could have 30 from Pascal Siakam one night, then Tyrese Halliburton's going to get 24, then maybe even, and then in terms of where this lineup is at, you might see something from Andrew Nembhard or Aaron Nesmith in terms of scoring. There were different ways to which the Pacers could beat the opposition. And then the early goings of this series, and at the back end of the regular season, it felt like it's Pascal Siakam or bust to some extent. You need 35 from him, but if he's not going, where's the rest of the offense going to come from? And then these last three games, it's felt like a return to form of where they were at the back stretch of the regular season. Do you agree with that? And does it feel like they are back towards, hey, it doesn't just have to be a 35-point night from Siakam. There's other layers, Miles Turner, for example, that can get the job done.
You know, I would argue, Jimmy, you don't even necessarily want it to be a 35-point night from anyone, because if Tyrese Halliburton or Pascal Siakam are scoring 35 to 40 points, the rest of the guys just subconsciously maybe don't feel as involved. And when they are playing their best basketball, they've got seven or eight in double figures, and you want to see three guys between, let's say, 20 and 25, and then another two or three contributing between 12 and 15. That's Pacers basketball, and all those points add up to a good number, and you're seeing them get to 125, which you don't see a lot of playoff scores get to that point. And, you know, we're seeing them accumulate assist numbers that are much like the regular season, and you don't see that when you look around at some of these other playoff series. To have three straight games with at least 30 assists in the playoffs when, again, like Tyrese Halliburton said, the thought is the game has to slow down and maybe there's more isolation. It's a real tribute to them continuing to do what they do and have it succeed on a different level in the playoffs. And back to what you said, I think March was important for this team. They had a sustained number of games with that starting lineup, getting some rhythm and getting some flow together. When they went to that starting lineup, when Halliburton came back and you had Pascal Siakam, I think everyone was looking around a little bit. And Andrew Nembhard is someone that now he knows his role. Now he knows he can score. He's not the number one option, but he knows when it's his time. And again, everyone sort of understands really what they're supposed to do. It's just a matter of executing and knocking down shots, which they've done that with regularity as well.
Jeremiah, you're around, obviously, the Pacers game in and game out. I mean, that goes without saying, but also at shoot-arounds, practices, things like that. Over the course of, and we'll go since the trade, okay, in the installment that we know them now with Pascal Siakam, has there been wavering at all or like ebb and flow just in terms of approach, the light atmosphere, the fun that the team's having? Where does their mindset compare right now to what you've seen over the flow of the season?
I think there was a little bit of an adjustment because when Pascal Siakam was acquired, you had Tyrese Halliburton, but maybe you didn't have him at his normal self because he was so concerned about getting healthy. And he was on the minutes restriction, and that would affect someone's mood and personality. And so much of this team's off-the-court attitude and demeanor, it starts with Tyrese Halliburton. So I think once he sort of started feeling better, everything did fall into line a little bit. I'll be honest, I was a little concerned with removing Buddy Hield from the equation, not because of his three-point shooting, because he had been okay this season, but it wasn't game-changing, it didn't seem to me. But I just thought he was kind of that personality that kept the locker room light. He would say something, make a joke, make everyone laugh. The bus would kind of erupt at times because of something that Buddy Hield would do or say. And I thought for the most part during his time, he was a really good person to have around. He just, like I said, kept the mood light. And so when you took him out, you were looking for that person, that personality. And I think over the course of the season, the rookies, they start to feel a little bit more comfortable. You know, guys like Ben Shepherd and Jairus Walker, in November and December, you're just looking around trying not to make a mistake and not to make anyone upset. And even though, you know, Jairus Walker specifically, I've seen his personality really come out in the second half of the season. And that's not saying he's impacting this series on the court, but it all contributes to what you're saying. And you look at the Western Conference, I've seen a couple of articles about the Thunder and the Timberwolves and about how the key to their success is how well they get along and how much they enjoy being around each other. If you get to April and May and you don't like being around each other, you're less excited about winning and keeping this season going. And I think the Pacers fall into a similar category as those teams I just mentioned out west because they've got a young group, because they really get along. There's no envy on this roster. If guys aren't playing, they don't hang their head. They're not upset. They appreciate the success of their teammates. And so maybe a little bit of a transition to your original point, but I'm seeing really – good chemistry, really from March on, I would say, once Tyrese Halliburton really was removing the minutes restriction.
Valley Sports Indiana's Jeremiah Johnson joins us. Jeremiah, this from Eddie Garrison Stats and Info, as I'm for now calling it henceforth. The Pacers are the first team in over 30 seasons to average 30-plus assists per game in the playoffs. I get it. Very small sample size, just through four games. But where is the line for this team between making the extra pass and being too selfless, if that makes sense?
I think you saw it a little bit in game three because there were times as I was watching, there was a little hesitation. And I saw that even a little bit in game one. You know, this team thrives on getting out and going in the transition and those fast break opportunities. And a lot of times those are going to be plays that are assists because you have it in your hand so quickly. It's a run out. Whoever throws the run-out pass, there's going to be an assist there. But you don't want to be too unselfish. I think one of their mottos has been, you know, from good to great. But if you get a really good shot, you don't really want to pass it up because at times that shot clock is winding down, and the one that is with two or three on the shot clock oftentimes isn't going to be as good as the one you passed up. So I think it's an important point that if you get a good shot, if your feet are set and you're ready to go, then let it go. And Tyrese Halliburton actually would be someone that I would watch in that area and was watching at times in the end of the season and end of this playoff series. You know, catch and shoot it, he would be open, but we also know he likes to take a dribble first. So if he has enough room to catch, dribble, then pick it back up and shoot it, that's his perfect routine. But I understand what you're saying. I think that you can be too unselfish, but I would probably never worry about that. If you're unselfish and you're always looking for your teammate, it's usually a pleasant problem.
Jeremiah Johnson is our guest. Pacers, Bucks, Milwaukee tonight. Game number 6 in Milwaukee, obviously. So, JJ, one guy that I'm curious about, and I don't want to – did I say 6? Game 5. I told you I keep screwing that up. 3-1 lead, obviously, for Indiana. One guy that to me – I don't want to put the cart before the horse and say automatically that Indiana advances past this round – but in terms of the shortening of rotation, do we start to see minutes coming back again situationally depending on next opponent for Jalen Smith, or is this just something where the rotation has been shortened and he's kind of been odd man out? Is it scheme or is it by design that he has not been on the floor a lot?
It's a good question. I would say initially maybe scheme, because you looked at who Milwaukee had in their second unit, and they maybe didn't have a true center, and you saw an opportunity with Obi Toppin to be that backup five, to be a little bit quicker, and maybe a little bit performance-based. I don't think the early minutes from Jalen Smith were good, and then when you shortened the rotation in game two and you went that direction and you had so much success, you're probably not going to change it. I hate to answer too many questions, and I know the coaches and players would never answer a question about a future series, but we can do that here in this platform. And the Knicks, if you do play the Knicks with how well they rebound, it would stand to reason you're going to need a lot of your best rebounders out on the court. And so that would be my message to Jalen Smith. Don't hang your head right now, and there's a very good chance you would be needed in another matchup. But as it is right now, the Bucks are just not a team that throws a lot of size out there in their second unit. And we've also seen the Pacers starters increase their minutes maybe from the regular season, so they're still going to be less available for those second unit players. And I think Rick Carlisle is pretty comfortable right now with an eight-man rotation. But depending upon the situation, he doesn't hesitate. Let's say Doug McDermott goes in for 4 minutes. The same thing could happen for Jalen Smith. And if you play really well in those 4 minutes, then you might earn another 4 or 5 minutes. And so you haven't seen the last of him. It just hasn't really worked out for him this series.
Jeremiah, are we past the point, or is it too late in the season where the Pacers can become a we solved it, consistent on a nightly basis, three-point shooting team? Because I feel like so much of the regular season, there were nights where when they were on, it's a W. And there were other nights where if they were off from beyond the arc, they probably had to work a little harder, or maybe it was going to be a loss. And there's been instances of that, mainly just game one, and they've figured things out, even though they did have a cold shooting night the other night, even in a win in game three. Are we ever going to be at a point where they fully are consistent on a nightly basis, or are they are who they are, which is working pretty well for them right now?
Yeah, I mean, that's tough, because I don't know that anyone could go into a game and say, you know, I guarantee this team's going to shoot 40% from three, or they're going to make 18 of them, unless you've got, you know, Steph Curry and Klay Thompson, and that's a standard that's tough to hold the average team up to. They have a team of above-average shooters, but I'm not sure that they have anyone, even though Aaron Nesmith at times is in the top five of the league, that you would say, oh, he's one of the best three-point shooters in the NBA. So because of that, you're going to have some variance. The one thing that I'll say, you know, I thought that at the beginning of the season, knowing they wanted to be, you know, continue to be three-point shots and layups, and with the amount of threes I thought they would take this season, I thought if they shoot 35 to 40% on any given night, they could beat about anybody. And if they shoot in the 20s, they'll struggle. And a lot of the splits have backed that up. But at halftime, when I talked with Lloyd Pierce in game four, the Pacers had the lead and they were knocking down their 3-point shots, but you can get a little bit too comfortable just shooting those. And he said, we're a paint first team. We've got to attack the paint. And so the whole key is don't give up on the paint. Don't settle with the 3-point shots, even when they're going down. Get inside and try to score, but then get inside and kick it out. So a lot of it's just, you kind of know it when you see it. If the shots are in rhythm and the catch and shoot opportunities are for Tyrese Halliburton, take two dribbles and shoot, I'm confident they've figured it out. You're still going to have an off night. And if tonight, for some reason, they're really struggling and they can't get the points in the paint, well, that'll be how Milwaukee wins the game. But it doesn't mean if that happens tonight that they've forgotten how to play or to shoot. I think you just have those nights every once in a while. So they're more consistent than they were. No team is going to be perfect, but I do think they've figured out a little bit with that, the way they play that offense and the way Miles Turner is shooting outside the arc. I like their chances.
Well, and that's the thing, Jeremiah. Isn't there probably some necessity, even if Turner doesn't get his shot going early, to continue to utilize him around the arc just to pull Brook Lopez out and make him work? You know, if Lopez is going to have to be one of their two offensive bell cows, don't you want to wear him down as much as you can and make him have to be fluid on both ends of the floor?
Absolutely. And, you know, when you acquire Pascal Siakam, it even, to me, it emphasizes Miles Turner's outside shot even more. It's a better fit, obviously, with Siakam and Turner than we saw for a number of years with, you know, Siakam or Turner and Sabonis, and they tried to make that work. But Siakam still is going to live in the two-point area a little bit more than Turner, and Turner's outside, and he's such a good three-point shooter, especially if you know, he's got that open look, and Tyrese Halliburton's working so well with him. But Brook Lopez, they're trying to figure out who is best for Brook Lopez to guard, because it probably makes sense with his style to guard Pascal Siakam, but that's a tough challenge as well. And, you know, you like him to be free to just be able to go help and block shots, but he definitely will struggle getting out there to guard Miles Turner. I'll give the coaching staff and Miles Turner credit. While they didn't come out right and say it during that week of practice and preparation, there was a really good idea that Turner could be a swing player in the series because of that Brook Lopez matchup that you mentioned. And how about Miles Turner? Tuesday night after the Pacers' first win, he had 22 points. I said, you know, was this the best? Or I asked him if this was the best playoff performance of his career. He said, until the next one, and he's done it again. So he keeps improving. We'll see what he has in store in Game 5 tonight.
Jeremiah, if you are needing caffeine because of the late tip tonight, find our Australian buddies Michael and Luke. They might have some because they've been out bar hopping since 9 this morning. So they're going to need some as well.
I've seen them at both of the games at Gainbridge Fieldhouse. Are they going to stay through the entirety of the playoffs?
No, they fly out of Chicago tomorrow. So they went ahead and went to Milwaukee. They're going to the game tonight. And then they fly out of Chicago tomorrow. So,
well, that's a good deal. The other thing I noted, the crowds were great, obviously, at Gainbridge Fieldhouse. Didn't see a lot of green. I'm expecting to see more blue and gold in Milwaukee tonight. But shout out to the fans in Indy and those that are making the trip to Milwaukee tonight.
Jeremiah, enjoy it. We will talk soon, all right?
Sounds good.
Jeremiah Johnson, Bally Sports and Pacers Television, Game 5 tonight, right? Thank you, Eddie. And in that honor of it being Game 5, we're going to take Caller 5 right now at 239-1070, Sancio Grand Prix on the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Road Course. That is coming up next weekend to kick off the month of May. And we have a pair of tickets to give away to Caller number 5. 239-1070 is the telephone number. We will do that. We'll come back with Jimmy's picks of the day as well.